big rocks and all that sort of thing.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello! Hello! It's me, really.
Oh,
it's me. Did I fool you?
Yeah,
I fooled you, didn't
that's
I?
That's amazing.
You were like, who's that?
Yeah. Thank God it's Mick Wall.
Readers, and thank God it's John Hotton.
Yeah. We're back.
We're back.
Still.
We're back. Still the same. Is that how the song goes? Right, John. Now, I think we're gonna carry on with the news, because there's been a lot of news.
There was, yeah, that's right. We were just going to, we promised a bonus episode, and this is it. This is your bonus episode.
Okay, now I was looking at some of the information you were sending me while I was
carefully
having my blood changed. And one thing that really caught my eye, which is very you, very you, was the fact that a box set is coming out, Anno Domini.
Yes, this is everywhere.
1989 to 1995.
The greatest era of which band?
This is, can you believe it? This is the first ever boxed set celebrating singer Tony Martin.
The cat.
The other cat.
Yeah, the other cat. Not the cat, not Bob the cat.
Which cat came first? I think Bob the cat came
first.
Bob
the cat by a mile.
By a mile?
By a mile.
So what was Tony the cat doing? Was he just a stray?
Yeah.
He was a stray?
Yeah.
You see what I did there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He strayed? Yeah.
He strayed into Black Sabbath one unfortunate morning.
He was scratching at the back door and Naomi went, ooh, ooh, ooh.
But you know what's odd? Keeping my eye on social media is that the person who's pumping all of this out on social media is Tony Iommi.
Yeah.
He's gone nuts for it. He's like, the first box set of The Cat, you know, it's great.
Well, in fairness, like, what else has he got to do all day?
Well, I don't know, but
Iommi.
Well, I mean, he could be pumping out a box set of Dio, couldn't he, or something?
Yeah, but the truth is they don't pump anything out, do they? It's all catalogue people at the label.
Yeah.
Someone's emailed him or his manager and gone, here, look,
we
can make a few
bob
here.
They've gone to town here. They have gone to town. They've got vinyl of all of them.
Vinyl?
There's some Iommi.
Have you got a record player out of interest?
No.
No, I haven't either.
There's some Iommi solo record or something on there. There's all of this, you know.
It's amazing they've never put it out before with all this incredible, valuable stuff.
To find the Hitler's cross. That's the one that's on the
who was that singing that time? Were you doing Steve Perry again?
It was the cat.
Which cat are we talking about?
Tony the cat.
Tony the cat.
Bob the cat. Bob the cat in Sabbath would have been quite good.
In fact.
Now he's without a band.
In fact, you might have hit on
something. Both from Birmingham. Iommi, Bob Catley, Geezer Butler, you're away.
And also, don't forget, Bob the Cat,
yeah,
he's used to having a guitarist called Tony.
He is, so he doesn't even have to rethink the name.
He doesn't have to rethink.
No, that's right.
What fantastic Magnum songs could they do in that lineup, though?
Well, yeah, because Iommi would be up for it, wouldn't he?
Of course he would. He was going to do Evil Woman by ELO.
Yeah. Maybe he's going to do Evil Woman by Black Sabbath. I think you might have got that wrong.
Did you say I might have got something wrong?
Yeah, I think you are.
I think that's ever, that's a precedent that's never been set.
I think you, because what was interesting was they
Evil Woman.
No. Evil Woman, don't you play your games with me.
No.
Evil no. Woman, don't I'll play
tell you
your
why.
Games.
I'll tell you why. Because when Jeff Nichols said, every time Iommi counted it in, we all burst out laughing.
Yeah, probably
it was. Because it was Evil woman. Digga, digga, digga,
digga. Who was going to sing that then?
Gillan.
Ian Gillan.
Yeah, because they had Bevan on drums.
Yeah, no, I know that Bevan, but you mean you need the whatever.
Look, getting Gillan in the first place was clearly a joke, so they may as well do Evil Woman.
But the interesting thing with it, to drag this back on track. The photo of Black Sabbath with the cat that Iommi is tweeting out, the lineup, the cat lineup. Do you know what it was?
Well, I've got it in front of me here. It's the cat.
It's the cat. Tony the cat.
Tony. Darth Vader.
Sorry, Iommi. It's Tony the cat and Tony Iommi. That's why he was called the cat.
Tony the cat.
Because you couldn't have two Tonys.
If any readers are noticing background voices, it's purely family members.
It's the spirits coming
I've locked
through.
Them in the cupboard. They're just making a fuss about coming out.
It's the spirits coming through.
So we've got Tony the cat, Tony Darth Vader, Cozy Powell, and Neil Murray.
What a lineup that was! In no way could you have put that lineup together literally in the marquee.
Me and
on any given evening.
Me and Dante went to see, may have been Black Sabbath, but with Ozzy back in it, like in 97 at the NEC. And, you know, we're driving and we stop off at a hotel or something, you know. And in the same bar was Neil Murray, Cozy Powell, Tony the Cat, and one, two others. I can't remember who they were. But we were going, is that like the spare lineup?
Yeah.
In case
because it was like, because I mean, you make a joke. I mean, they were both great musicians, Cozy and Neil Murray. But it's like they were in every band that you could think of.
That's why it was a false economy hiring them.
Yeah. I mean, because you go and see Gary Moore and it would be Neil Murray and Cozy Powell. And then you go and see Whitesnake and it would be Neil Murray and Cozy Powell. And then you go and see Rainbow and it would be Neil Murray and Cozy. They were just in everything.
Yeah, they were. They were the rhythm section du jour.
Yeah. And they rock, you know, they'd just been in Whitesnake and all of a sudden they rock up in Black Sabbath or something.
I was talking to a friend of mine earlier this week who recently interviewed Neil Murray, and he was remarking on Neil's, how would you describe it? He's got quite a sort of wintry outlook sometimes.
Right, yeah.
You know, that old saying, the glass is half full or the glass. Yeah. I think with Neil, there's no glass.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just no glass.
Someone's taken his glass. It's last orders, and they've taken his glass, and he still had a little bit of beer in the bottle that he wanted.
Well, I tracked Neil down when I was doing my Sabbath book over 10 years ago now. And
he was very happy to hear from you.
He wasn't, no. Yeah. I mean, we did talk, but he said, I wasn't sure whether to, you know, take your call. And I said, oh, why? And he said, oh, just some things maybe that you know, were written over the years.
Yeah, I bet I can guess what.
Really? Because I couldn't. What? Well,
there's no way. I mean, it must have been View from the Bar, which, you know, spoiler alert, you used to write.
Yeah, but every week it was
oh, here's Neil Murray, you know, every single week.
Because he was at every single gig, every single part. He was the leader of the year.
Yeah, yeah. So when Iommi looked at, see, this is the thing I'm trying to get across of this box set. I mean, I know now it has, you know, it's that classic thing of, when you like something, you have to like the most obscure version of it, or you have to like the version that no one else likes.
Yeah.
So you kind of go,
is that why you like this lineup?
Well, you go, oh, well, I'm a big fan of Knott's Forest, you know, but I like them in after Brian Clough when they got relegated for six seasons in a row, whatever. It's that kind of thing. It's like, you know. Oh, I liked the spin-off from Steptoe.
I think the Brits are really good at this. We love an underdog, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, this is now the Black Sabbath album to say that you like.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I really liked it when Tony the Cat Martin.
Yeah.
No, you didn't. Yeah. No one liked it when Tony the Cat Martin. No. That's why they were playing, you know, Shepherd's Bush Empire and not...
And why they didn't play America for about 4 years.
Exactly, yeah. And why, you know, everyone was chuckling away at the fact he was, because let's try and emphasise the shock of Tony the Cat Martin, who, let's face it, none of us had ever heard of, turning up in a band who, first of all, had Ozzy Osbourne, and then they had Ronnie Dio. And Dio had dragged them back. I mean, losing Ozzy was regarded as probably a terminal blow. But Dio comes along and drags them back.
And actually drags them into the 80s.
Yeah, I mean,
and also restores their sales, their reputation.
Puts them back on a level, or almost on a level with Ozzy, whose solo career is going through the roof. All of a sudden they make Heaven and Hell. Tremendous record. Absolutely stood the test of time. One of the great hard rock records of all time. And, you know, so Dio's sort of put them back on this pedestal.
But from there, it was a slippery slope.
Then it's Ian Gillan, which is just...
a joke.
A drunken night. And then it is just... they hit the skids,
They did. Well, there was David Donato.
David Donato, who he was or wasn't in the band, depending on who you believe.
I think the answer is he was in the band and then he wasn't. And they just said, well, he was never in the band in the first place.
Tony
we're not a joke. We're not. There's nothing weird and stupid about this.
Tony just did his thing. Oh, no one told me.
No one told me who was standing over there the last 6 weeks singing.
I just did a photo session with him. Oh, no one told me.
And those interviews, I looked them up, and Donato's going, whenever I pictured Black Sabbath, I only ever pictured me singing with them. I always go, who are you?
Yeah.
You're not in the band.
So then they get, then didn't they get Ray Gillan? Was it Ray Gillan they had briefly?
No, there was about three between.
Yeah.
There was the guy who ended up being a televangelist. There was Ron Keel. Yeah, there was a whole fucking load of them. And then the classic... because, you know, Geezer always insisted that the lineup with Gillan was never meant to be Sabbath.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he didn't.
Well, that's bullshit. That's why Bill Ward was dragged out of retirement to play on it.
Because it did make a kind of... you could see it making kind of sense. You know, they've had Ozzy, they've had Dio. So you do need a singer of some stature
and
to follow.
And at that point, they'd actually approached Robert Plant, who turned it down. They approached David Coverdale, who turned it down.
So they're looking at a certain level for
their
singer.
They're casting the net wide.
Yeah, they are.
A certain level.
But it's like you know, it's like sort of Man United buying a striker. You know, they're not looking down the divisions Rotherham or something.
No.
They're looking across at who have Bayern Munich got, who have Barcelona got. You know, that's the sort of thing they were doing.
Yeah. And... to the point where you get what was supposed to be the first Tony Iommi solo album.
Which was Seventh Star. Well, we've left out the other one, which is Glenn Hughes.
Well, no, that's why I'm mentioning Seventh Star, because that was the album
that's
Glenn appeared on.
Exactly, yeah. And again, that was the whole story of that.
Lasted half a tour.
It wasn't meant to be a Sabbath album. It was meant
wasn't. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't. They added that Sabbath thing purely for the bucks. Yeah. Don Arden added it.
Yeah.
And it got to the absurd point of it was Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi.
Yeah. But even so, even at that point, at least Glenn Hughes is a name. Well, he's a name, isn't he? I mean, regardless of whether he can sing or not.
He was their second ex-Deep Purple vocalist.
Exactly. You know who Glenn Hughes is.
They should have got Graham Bonnet.
That would have been all right, actually. I get the same old dreams, same time every night.
That's you and your mate Russ Ballard, isn't it?
Yeah, fall to the ground and I wake up.
You look a bit like Graham Bonnet.
So
did
I get
ever
out
tell
of
you?
There, put on my shoes and in my head.
That is who you are.
Yeah.
You know, when you do the gigs.
Your poison letter.
Yeah, you turn up looking like you're in Miami Vice.
Yeah.
You know, you're that Graham Bonnet vibe.
Looking sharp.
That is definitely a word that... yeah. Might be applied in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
So anyway, all this bullshit, and then finally it's all over.
And along comes Tony the Cat.
There's no Bill Ward, there's no Bev Bevan, there's no Glenn Hughes, there's no fucking Ray Gillan, there's nothing. He's over, it's finished, no geezer, nothing.
So you get Cozy Powell.
Who's your mate.
Who's your mate, yeah.
Who likes to earn a... yeah. Few bob.
And it must be if you're Iommi and you've been through all of this, it must be kind of reassuring to go, oh, actually, you know, Cozy and Neil Murray, I know them, I know they can play. Yeah, you don't need to worry. That's the whole point. That's why they got so much work, was because utterly reliable. You know them. They can do. They can play anything,
great players.
And they've done, seasoned. They've done thousands of gigs.
All they were missing was a charismatic frontman.
Yeah. So I think what happened is, I think they thought, let's get Bob the Cat. Let's see what Bob the Cat. And they just got the wrong cat.
Yeah. They heard a scratching at the studio door one night.
Naomi just said to his manager, whoever it was at that point,
Get me the cat.
Yeah.
Don't come back until you've got the cat.
And I want him here tomorrow.
Oh, you know where it's at?
Because I got riffs.
Get me the cat.
Because I got riffs, man.
Yeah, I got riffs.
Yeah.
And you know where it's at. Get me the cat.
John Travolta said, I've got riffs. They're multiplying. That's what Naomi said.
And then he said, this is where it's at. Get me the cat.
Yeah.
I've said that a few times.
You have, yeah.
Still, so far, no reaction whatsoever.
Yeah, okay. No.
It can't be because it's naff. Yeah.
So they did get him the cat. They got him Tony the Cat. Tony the Cat Martin. And what would you say Tony the Cat Martin looks like?
In this picture you sent me?
Yes, in that picture you've got there.
I mean,
I would say he looks like, if you turned up at Birmingham Edwards Number 8 Rock Club, he'd be the promoter. That's what he looks like.
I thought you were going to say he'd be on the door.
You go, all right, lads, put your gear in the back. Yeah, we had, Pink Fairies here last night, and we've got Russ Ballard tomorrow, and we got you tonight. Great stuff. We're nearly sold out.
To me, he looks more like a footballer.
Do you think?
Yeah, like I played with Frank Worthington in the 70s.
Oh, you're saying him, right, yeah. Oh, so you mean
like... played with Frank Worthington?
You might have done.
God, definitely.
Well, no, I mean in a charity game or something, you might have done. You must have played in the charity football match.
Nah.
You must have. Did you not play in the match we played against Deep Purple?
No, I don't play football.
I thought you might have played in that.
I was wasted, man.
Yeah, you probably were.
I couldn't be scraped.
Richie Blackmore's really good.
Richie Blackmore was the only one I nearly played football with.
He was bloody good at football. You wouldn't expect it, but he was like super, super fast runner, super athletic, yeah.
Someone should have done a Norman Hunter.
Yeah, they said you couldn't get near enough to him.
Well, that's because he was magic. He had magic in his toes. Yeah,
and he did keep subbing himself on and off, so...
So listen, let's be honest.
So they've got the cat, and they make...
This
how
is
many,
the worst lineup of
Sabbath ever.
But
they make a stack of albums with the cat, don't they? They make Headless Cross.
Well, they make three.
Headless Cross! And then they make...
Tear. See, big mistake. Don't put out... Don't call your band something people don't know how to pronounce it. Don't call your out. So you walk in the in those days, walk in the shop. Oh, have you got the new album by Sabbath? Oh, what's it called? Tyre.
Yeah, Tyre. What?
No, we got Tyr. It's T-Y-R.
Yeah.
Could be Tyre.
Could be Tyre, yeah.
Could be Tyr.
Yeah.
What is it? I don't even know what it is.
It could be something like the, the Celtic names where it's spelt C-I-O-G-H-L-I-P-F-T-O-N.
Just fucking call it.
But it's pronounced con.
They should have just called it Black Magic or something.
Yeah.
It's just easy.
Black Magic's... I can't believe they've never called anything Black Magic.
It's about time, isn't it? What's wrong with all you metal bands out there?
Black Magic.
And then Cross Purposes.
Never go with a pun.
When
we used to work on magazines... If you've got a pun, put it in a caption. That's as far as it goes.
Yeah.
Not in headlines, not even in subheads.
Well, it's like calling the new Def Leppard album in those days, calling it, I don't know, Never Change Your Spots.
Mutton Def.
Now, as a fellow producer, I can't say... I won't hear anything
That's
bad
good,
said
though,
about
Mark. If they redid it, if they did a box set of Hysteria and Pyromania, they'd just call it Mutt and Death. I'll give that to them for nothing. They can have that.
Mutt and Death.
Yeah.
We know he did three albums with them.
Did he?
Mm.
What one did he do? Did he do the one after Hysteria?
No, he did the one before Pyromania.
Did he?
High and Dry.
High and Dry. Did he?
Yeah.
No, I don't think he did.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Why do you even bother? You know I know this.
I don't. Do you? I don't know. Oh, Mutt Lange. I thought he'd just done John, Back in Black.
John.
He did Foreigner 4, Back in Black, and then he did Hysteria.
John.
Not
do you
his
know how
Pyromania.
Many fucking Def Leppard features I've written.
Yeah, and you've
these.
Got them all wrong.
Did I?
Yeah.
Shall we just check?
Even Mutt Lange, when I interviewed Mutt Lange, he goes, yeah, the people keep saying to me I produce High and Dry, because I don't remember that.
You never interviewed Mutt.
No, I didn't.
Right.
Why are you saying that with such certainty?
Because no one's ever interviewed Mutt.
That's
right.
Why.
I can't believe you're making me look.
I didn't make
I'm
you look
Mick
it up.
Wall.
You,
I know
you
produced
chose
the fucking album.
You chose to look it
but
up.
You said I got it wrong.
Well, you said you.
Oh,
were,
look, High and Dry.
You know that you're.
Producer, Robert John Mutt Lange.
There you go. You see, so you knew I was wrong. So why did you let it irritate you so much? I only do it to get the rise. I don't care who produced High and Dry. Why should I care who produced High and Dry?
Look, I won't hear a word said about Mutt, okay?
Okay.
Producers
Mutt
Union.
And Def. Okay, so if they do a box set of High and Dry, Pyromania and Hysteria, they can still call it Mutt and Def.
High and Dry was a great album.
Was it?
Yeah, it fucking what's was. Do you not know that?
What's your favourite track?
Let It Go.
Okay.
You really don't know High and Dry.
No,
I wasn't
you interested.
Know nothing.
Not
do you?
Interested.
Got no education
not
whatsoever.
Interested.
Really?
Not. See, this is why Mutt doesn't say that he produced it, because it doesn't sound like Mutt Lange.
It so fucking does. In a minute, it goes into that AC/DC Foreigner thing. That's
right.
When you know it's Mutt. Mm. Driving in America. Wait till the chorus. Get rhythm. Building. Mutt's going.
Yeah, louder.
Here we go. Let it roll. Let it go.
Yeah, that's enough of that.
Don't you knock High and Dry? There's a lot of people who say that's their very
yeah,
favourite.
Yeah, it's like all the people who say that Headless Cross is their favourite Black Sabbath album.
What do you mean
doesn't
all
make
the people?
Well, they do. Honestly, ever since Iommi... Exactly, no one bought it. Ever since Iommi's been tweeting this stuff, everyone, all the comments underneath are absolutely my favourite era of Sabbath. I can't believe it's taken this long.
Yeah, High and Dry went platinum.
So?
Okay, so there's no... It's not like...
I think it went retrospectively platinum. I mean, Headless Cross is just about to go platinum because the box set's coming out.
You have to buy a record for it to go
yeah,
platinum.
Yeah, oh, yes.
No
you,
one
you,
buys
what
records.
What are you trying to say?
No,
you don't think people are going to buy this?
No. I'll tell you what it is. It's the same old bollocks that they do with all Sabbath stuff. They'll put all this shit in a box and they'll sell it for 50 quid or 100.
That will be very, very Sabbath.
But
Sharon,
the actual, but if you want,
an
if
actual
you want,
shit in a box.
If you want to hear Headless Cross, you don't have to go and spend a load
cross.
Of money on fucking rubbish. Look, 2024 remaster.
Cozy.
Compressed drums.
Actually, I don't know if Cozy was on the album itself.
No, I don't
he,
know
or... Doesn't sound... Sounds absolutely nothing like Heaven and Hell.
Right? I did not just spend £100 on a crummy box. I just Spotify it.
Yeah.
And that's
okay.
What most people with sense do.
Yeah.
But they sell these things for so much money that you only get...
have to sell a few.
I reviewed one years ago, and on the cover it had featuring interviews with all original members and poster and plectrum and all this. There wasn't a single band member on there. There was Malcolm Dome, the singer of Orange Goblin, talking right. about how influential.
Influential, yeah.
The poster was about as big as a hanky. Yeah. The plectrum.
He's saying it was a con.
It was on sale for 120 quid.
Yeah. It was a special
edition. And this is before Spotify. So I went to Amazon.
Especially full of crap.
And totted up what it would cost me to buy the original Ozzy albums. And it was like, you know, 10 quid or something. Yeah. This was like 125 quid. So I reviewed it. And at the end, I just said, don't take the piss. And I bumped into the guy who did that for Universal. Some months later, and he was still smarting over it. But it was at a Classic Rock Awards, and he was sitting with all his bum chums from Universal, and he was like, yeah, he gave it a shit review. We still sold 5,000 copies.
Yeah. So that's
in other words, they made about
do.
Half a million quid.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So anyway, what are we saying? We're saying avoid this.
I have zero interest in box sets anymore. Yeah. You know, you've got to go back to the last century to really, really, you know, find something worth having.
But it's a good bit of marketing to make a virtue of your sort of worst period.
Shittest records.
This is paving the way for our genius idea. It was like when me and Paul Elliott thought up the worst of Iron Maiden.
No, that was you and me thought that up.
You're trying to chime in on that one.
No, that was you and me.
You were terrified of it. You said, oh, I couldn't say it's Rod Smallwood. I couldn't say that. Me and Paul Elliott were saying it should be Run Silent, Run Deep, their greatest song.
No, just the worst
yeah,
of Iron
the worst
Maiden.
Of Iron Maiden. That was the idea, yeah.
Opening track, Mother Russia.
Yeah, Mother Russia, Dance of the Tsars.
Oh, my God.
It was great.
My God. Yeah. Right, so marching on.
To find marching the Hitler's on. Cross.
Dude, I've got to tell you, when I did the Sabbath book, I tried very, very hard to get into...
You tried to condense that era of the band into a few hundred words.
No!
That's what I would have tried to do.
Well, no, I tried to actually get deep into the weeds. I'm trying to find your news email, hang on.
Oh.
Trying to get deep into the weeds. And, you know, the truth is there is some...
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
There is some good stuff on those records. But I think...
Such as?
Tony...
Exactly.
Track three.
You just
track three.
You're just saying.
I just said there's some good.
You're just saying words.
Track three is my
right,
favorite.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah,
which proves I know.
But
what
it's
I'm
weird
talking
that
about.
It's track three on all of the three albums.
I know, isn't that? Do you think they did that deliberately?
I don't know. They just must think.
I think it's
what
a
the best
test.
Track is.
If they say what's your favorite track and you say track three, that proves that you've actually listened
to
the first
at least
two.
Three tracks. Yeah,
and you've got a favorite. Yeah. Which is track three. So I'm gonna throw a googly at you. That's a cricketing term.
Very good, yeah.
Apparently, we've completely missed the news. I know I did, that Brian Tatler is now in Saxon.
I was amazed by this. Brian Tatler.
We should remind people who Brian is, because not everybody
knows. Not everybody knows, but one of the most significant bands of the new album. Never really made it, but undoubtedly their musical significance lived on, particularly through Metallica, who were enormous fans of this band, were Diamond Head.
Yeah. I thought when Diamond Head first came out, because I was active, as it were, at the time, I thought they were going to be like the next Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I mean, they were like, you know, they were sort of, a lot of the new album bands were, you know, at the demo stage, shall we say. Whereas... Diamond Head sounded like this huge.
Yeah,
giant.
They sounded like the finished article.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everybody swooped. You know, Mensch wanted to manage them before he went to manage Leopard.
Yeah. And the sort of genius behind Diamond Head was Brian Tatler, the guitarist, who came up with, like Iommi, was just this sort of riff merchant who came up with these giant riffs at the drop of a hat.
Well, he came up with like, Am I Evil? Yeah. And all these things that Metallica have turned into a career.
Yes, I am. And they had a great singer, Sean Harris, who kind of looked a bit plant-like, didn't he? Was
exactly.
Like, good-looking guy.
He had a headband.
Yeah. And they were from Stourbridge, I think. So
the Midlands.
If ever there was a statue needed erecting in Stourbridge, it would be of Diamond Head.
And I don't know if this next bit is fair or necessarily true, so I'm going to say it.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of handed down received wisdom about Diamond Head, they turned down Mensch, but then Marillion turned down Mensch. You know, people did turn down Mensch, and of course, all their careers suffered. Def Leppard didn't turn down Mensch, and look what happened to them. The received wisdom that I picked up was that the problem was the band were managed by Sean Harris's mum.
Oh, okay, right.
So you couldn't, the minute you go, oh, that was a, why did we do that? We should never have done that. It's Sean's mum.
Yeah.
That's a tough spot, isn't it?
It is, because I think all bands reach that point, don't they? I mean, you know, Metallica obviously went to...
Ended up, they did go to Mensch after
but,
3 hours.
But that was kind of, yeah, they had to get out from under Johnny Z, didn't they? And that it's difficult because those people have got you to a certain place. And bands that are on the cusp of being big, they do face that choice of right now, do we take that step up, get the new management, because those management are...
It's way outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, they're used to dealing with, you know, huge record companies and all of those things, and they take you to the next level. But you do have to fire your mum or the equivalent of your mum, you know, your mate who's been with you the whole time. You have to get rid of them. And it's tough to do.
The bands that don't, like Diamond Head, but even Thunder, you know, Malcolm McKenzie was originally the singer until Danny came along.
Right.
And then they tried to, I think he tried to learn the bass or something like that, and that didn't work out. So he became the manager because he was the mate.
Yeah, and this is quite often the thing that happens.
Because it's that comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to get outside that
job. You have to. You get to a point where you have to take that next step and say, we are going to go with the Mensch, Rod Smallwood, whoever it is.
I remember when I did the Marillion book saying to them, I didn't know that Mensch had come in for them. And I was like, Mensch came in for you? Because by this point, he's Leopard. And
yeah.
He's like 87 or something. And they were like, oh, yeah, no, we didn't like him. I was really, I said, what was the problem? They went, well, he's American, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, you do wonder, though, you do wonder what he could have done with them.
Pink Floyd?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but
Genesis?
That had all happened by then. It was like...
No. This is right at the beginning. This is literally at the beginning of their career. You know, this is Peter Mensch saying, I've got Def Leppard, I want you, I'm building an empire. You've got it. There's no reason why they couldn't have been big in America, except for the fact they never had a proper manager.
Yeah, maybe.
No, maybe about I mean, it, my
They're maybe slightly too idiosyncratic, I would say, but you could be right.
Yes, close to the edge.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, that was years before. That was years before.
Not
that,
that long.
Moment
had
gone.
Wait. 5 years before at this point.
Yeah, longer than that. I mean, if you're talking Marillion at 82, 83.
Yes.
Yeah, then you're going back. Yes, first got big in 72, 73.
But
that's
was still enormous
by
1984.
Yeah, they were still enormous. But that's like going, well, you know, Led Zeppelin was still enormous. It doesn't mean... You know, you're going to sign another band and make them into Led Zeppelin. It's just not going to particularly work like that, is it?
Well, we're going to disagree.
Sign a blues
because for
band.
Me, Marillion absolutely could have been huge in America.
See, I think
saw them play in America. It was exactly like watching them here before they got enormous. The crowds knew every single word. They sang every single word. I mean, it was happening.
Maybe, yeah, okay. I'll take your word for it, but... To go back to
maybe. What about Pink Floyd? How did they manage?
Well, look, again, you're talking about different eras, aren't you? You can't necessarily...
Not really,
this.
John.
I would say,
not in America.
My view would be that music was too idiosyncratic for America at that time. I think they would have either radically changed the band and they would have had to write different
Metallica.
Music.
Metallica?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Yeah, you could be right. As I say, you could be right.
Who would have said Metallica?
Well, I, the not least me, not bit me of commercial. For sure. But what I would say is they did massively change the music. I mean, the Black Album was what did it for them. And if you think about the Black Album, you know, all of a sudden they've gone from...
But what's the album and everybody Justice says is all, their best?
Master of Puppets. Hmm. Well, yeah, but that's, again, that's the headless cross scenario.
Master of
it?
Puppets went gold in America.
Yeah, that might be the fans' idea of what the best album is.
Master of Puppets went gold in America and sold over 500,000 copies.
Yeah, but let's be honest. I always counter
Justice
that argument.
Justice for All was double platinum.
Yeah, I always counter that argument. I remember when Derek Oliver became an A&R man in America and he signed a band called Tangiers, right? Mm. Who were, I mean, and just a generic AOR, the sort of thing that Derek would like. They went platinum. Right. No one remembers them. No one thinks. It was just at that time.
What's that got gold, to do with Marillion?
Because at that time, gold or platinum, I mean, I know you're saying it's a big thing, and it is a big thing, but it's like if you had a major record company behind you, you could basically go gold because you just could ship that many copies. You could do the promo. You could.
Are you saying people didn't buy Master of Puppets?
No, I'm not saying that.
I don't know what your point is. Look, my point is, Metallica were already... Yeah. Huge.
No.
Huge.
Okay, so that's my point. Gold isn't huge in America.
They were double platinum with And Justice for All.
Yeah,
it went on to sell 4 million.
Had they made another And Justice for All, which wasn't, let's be honest, isn't a great record.
It
doesn't sound great.
Doesn't matter. You're saying Marillion would not have made it in America because they were too idiosyncratic.
Yeah, because they would have had
Saying here's a group even more idiosyncratic
that no one gave a chance to. I agree, that's a very
Mensch
good
comes
point.
Along, yeah. Suddenly they're yeah. opening for Ozzy Osbourne on the hottest tour of the year. The album goes gold. They all get their first credit cards and mortgages on houses. They are fucking happening. And if Mensch hadn't come along, that would not
no,
have
I
happened.
Agree. I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, yeah.
But who's to say Marillion wouldn't have opened for Genesis Pink Floyd?
Yeah, they might well have done, yeah. And they might well have then come along and made a record that would have been their equivalent of the Black Album, which was essentially a broadscape rock album.
Well, they kind of did with Misplaced Childhood. They had a huge hit.
Everybody loved that album. Everybody did love that
album. That even went platinum here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's great.
No, I think they honestly, I think they had a fantastic opportunity and they fucked it up because they didn't have a Mensch.
Yeah, you could be entirely right on that.
No, could about it, mate. And also, Mensch would not have let them keep Mark Kelly and get rid of Fish because that was the choice.
Right, right.
That was the choice.
Yeah.
You know, because they've got John Arneson who'll do anything they say and. You know, Malcolm McKenzie and all these fucking guys who are nice guys. You don't want a nice guy.
Yeah,
you want an American badass motherfucker who knows how to get you in the charts.
Yeah, yeah, true, true.
And
that.
I honestly
true
think
that
Marillion had it in the palm of their hands with Clutching at Straws.
But would they have wanted it? Would they have wanted it?
Of course they would have fucking wanted it.
No, but now, I mean, you think about what they've got now.
John, give me a fucking break.
They've done better. They've done better, haven't they? They've got like a nice life.
They play the Town and Country Club, the Royal Albert Hall. How about 5 nights at Madison Square Garden?
Yeah, true.
No, true about it, mate. You want a guitar-shaped swimming pool in LA? They wanted it. Maybe they didn't.
I'm sure they wanted it. I'm just saying, I wonder if in retrospect you wouldn't have said what you've got now is better. Less stressful, nice living... Do whatever albums you want, still going well into your 60s, still got a big fan base.
Again, Metallica. You say Metallica don't do the albums they want. You're saying they got a stressful life?
No, not at all.
Well, I'm telling you, dude.
I think they have a more stressful life than Marillion do, I would argue.
Are you insane?
No, because it's just that huge mechanism, isn't it, that has to work all the time.
That you have loads of people doing it for you. You don't have to sit there emailing people going, oh, my wife's the PR, oh, and we're going to pay for the recording of our own album. We can't market it or promote it, but it's good on the internet. They're brilliant at what they do.
Yeah.
But trust me, they'd have bit your fucking arm off to have been where Metallica are today.
Oh, I'm sure in terms of the money and everything.
In terms of everything, my friend.
I don't know. I would hate that Metallica existence. I mean, you know. Because it just seems horrible to me.
In what way? Oh, sorry, hang on. Here's $100 million. Yeah. What's horrible about that?
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
Just tell me the horrible part.
Okay, the horrible part, I think, is the whole huge machine and the fact that without going into, you know, into people that you have to work with and all of that sort of thing, you know, it's like, oh, I've got to go on tour with these people for another whole year.
Dude, you do the same show, whether you're playing Madison Square Gardens or the pub down the road. You work with the same people, you make the same music.
Yeah, I mean, that's just my thing. I just wouldn't want to work with them.
With who?
Metallica.
You're not working with Metallica.
No, I know.
I'm saying you're at that level. I could easily say Bon Jovi, Guns N' Roses.
Oh, God, I hate to be in that, yeah.
What are you talking? The whole thing seems like I'm not talking about being in Bon Jovi. I'm saying being at that level of success.
Yeah. And I think it's a drag, to be honest. I think that huge, you know, it's great. The money is fantastic. But if you're Metallica, right, why are you still doing it?
Why are we still doing it? We don't get any money.
No. But they get, that's what I'm saying. They've got more money than they could ever spend.
That's why they put an album out every 10 years.
Yeah. It's like, why are they still doing it?
Why not?
Do they still do it?
Why not? They're musicians. What else are they supposed to do?
I don't know.
So Marillion, because no one's ever fucking heard of them outside this country, that's a better life.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
And Marillion
nice.
Goes, do you know what? We're glad we got rid of Fish.
I think it'd be really...
Didn't get our £1 million publishing deal.
I think it'd be really interesting, genuinely, to speak to them about it and say, what do you think? What do you think about that? Now that you're at the age you are, you've had the life you've had.
They will give you some cock and bull story. How do they even know? They've never been at that level.
Exactly, yeah, they don't know. They don't know. They don't know.
I know, because I have been.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? You know, it's to visit all these bands. I'd come off tour with David Lee Roth, next time with Marillion, and I'd be going, fucking hell, they're a bit boring, aren't they? You know, compared to what I've seen. Marillion, how often did they go to LA? Twice? You know, they've got no sense of what they could have had.
Yeah.
And I think that it's human nature to go, no, you know, no regrets. No, we couldn't have carried on with Fish. We did the right thing. And look, we've built this wonderful
thing.
I
don't think they would have carried on with Fish. I don't think they could have carried on with Fish.
If they'd got rid of a certain member, they would have had no problem.
Really?
Yeah. If they'd have got rid of him and brought in the guy that played keyboards on his first solo album.
Oh, yeah, Mickey...
Yeah.
Mickey someone.
Yeah.
Simmons, maybe?
Yeah. Fish was telling me just the other day, he said...
yes, because we need to reveal this, don't we?
I was interviewing Fish the other day for a forthcoming feature. And he was saying... Because, you know, I was basically saying this to him. And...
Because as we know, he's going to live on a croft. Mm. Which, strangely enough, he's got the croft next door to Lars Ulrich. That's what I
mean. He said, I can't remember the track he said. There's a track on that first album, Vigil. And he said he had the top line melody, he had the lyrics, he knew what he wanted to do with it. And Mark Kelly came over and he said he just wasn't interested. He said we spent an hour or two, he couldn't come up with anything and he left. He said it was horrible. He said I went around to see Mickey, was it?
Right.
He said 20 minutes, he came up with a fucking masterpiece. You know. Yeah. Because I think there was clearly personal problems between Mark and Fish. But, you know, everybody says Steve Hogarth is a much better keyboard player than Mark. Everybody says that in the band.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was that he was spectacular as a keyboard player. He was perfect for that band. But I would argue Fish in those days was spectacular as a frontman.
Oh, he was, undoubtedly. He was fantastic.
He was poised. The man was poised. And what they hated, you know, I was saying to him the other day, you know, Blitz magazine would interview him. He'd be in the Face. He'd be in the NME. Yeah. Of course, they would ridicule him, but he fucking fought
his point. Knew who, I mean, Viz was the great example. Because when they did Billy the Fish, they actually did a Fish version of it, didn't they? Where it was Fish from Marillion.
He's still like, Fish from Marillion to this day.
But that's how famous he was. Yeah, it's a good example.
He was in the tabloids every day. Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was fucking hard work. But Axl Rose is hard work. You're telling me James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich aren't fucking hard work?
Yeah, no, they are, yeah, for sure.
Mick Jagger, yeah. Jimmy Page. I mean, if you don't want to work hard with these people, then call Mensch, you know, don't do it. But I don't know. I mean, I was in America with them, and I thought, this is their oyster.
Yeah, yeah. But finish what you were saying about Fish, because it's interesting to hear that.
Interrupted me again.
In that he was talking about that point of Marillion and looking back at that now, how he feels about it and what happened and whether it should have happened and whether he would have done anything differently.
He was intent on breaking America.
Yeah.
After he got married, he flew straight to America. They had cancelled the tour. Rod Smallwood didn't have the guts to tell him to his face, as Fish. And he said, well, okay, you've cancelled the tour. I'll go to every radio station in the country. I'll drive myself. I will talk to them. I will work this. And of course, they were on Capitol Records in America, who were notoriously shit. Or maybe they had someone there saying, oh, it's too complicated or whatever. Yeah. But it just didn't,
See, that's interesting because that when you were saying to me that you were interviewing Fish, I said to you, oh, have you seen the Mark Kelly book? Because Mark Kelly had done a book some probably a couple of years ago now, and I remembered
you sent me.
I had a PDF of it, and it. I mean, it is. You know,
did you know Ian Mosley's done a book?
No.
According to Fish.
Oh, okay.
He said, "Have you read Mosley's book?" I went, "No, I didn't know he had one." Yeah. Unless I misunderstood.
Kept it on the DL. But. No, Kelly. So Kelly really goes for it in that book, but he does say when he's talking about the early days when Fish first joins, and actually Mark and Fish, this is according to Mark, have this sort of unholy alliance where Fish comes to Mark and says, "Oh, we're the two in this band. This band is me and you, you know, and the rest of them, you know, we're the heart of this band." Because Fish was the way he was painting Fish was literally the assassin, as Fish later wrote, you know, when they got rid of Diz Minnit, who was the original bass.
Mick Actually, Pointer.
Well, when they got rid of the keyboard player and got Mark, it was Fish that did
Brian,
the deed.
Whatever his name was. Yeah. Mick Pointer was the big sack.
Yeah, Mick Pointer was the assassin when they all turned up on his doorstep. But according to Mark, Fish was the assassin. And he was always... Mark was always on the back foot thinking, am I next? You know, who's next in the firing line?
Not necessarily a bad thing for a leader to instill in his troops.
A bit of fear. But that it's at that point, Fish goes, and he's like incredibly surprised. This is again in his book. Fish goes to him and says, oh no, this is me and you in this band. Mm. But then obviously from that point, it starts to fall apart and they become opposing forces within the band, and you know, as you say, Arneson comes along, and but
well,
Mark,
you said Fish was the assassin. Yeah. Fish wanted to sack Arneson. According to Fish, he had got the others to agree to sack Arneson, and the day they went to meet Arneson and sack him, Arneson had turned up early and sat with them for an hour and talked them all round, so that when Fish turned up, they were like, no, he's a good bloke, John, we're going to keep him.
Maybe, yeah.
And that's when Fish
was interesting, what my original point was, what Mark Kelly was writing about those early days with Fish was that Fish was doing exactly what you said. He was the guy on the phone to promoters.
Absolutely.
Going, you know, you've never heard of us, but my name is Fish, and we've got a band, and we want a gig, and that he was literally doing that.
Lars in Metallica.
Yeah.
Not to the same degree, but Slash and Guns N' Roses. Yeah.
But it was that thing of, you know, promoters would remember Fish, firstly because he was called Fish, and then he was, when he turned up, he was like 6'7" or whatever he is, and this huge guy, and in makeup, you just don't forget him, you know.
It's true.
So that does chime that idea that he would go and drive around record, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, he was completely thwarted, and I can totally picture the scene. You know, what's this guy want? You know, I've been there. Capitol Records was awful.
But you see, here's the thing though. I'd completely forgotten this, and just go back to people tweeting bits of old Kerrang. They tweeted a cover of Kerrang, which was Mark and Pete and a fish tank. Ray Palmer had done the pictures, obviously.
Is this after Fish left?
Yeah, and it was So Long and Thanks for All the Fish. And I'd written that feature, and I have no memory of that whatsoever. But I do remember at the same time going to interview Fish, and we did it at EMI when EMI was at Manchester Square. And he said it was something like it was late. It was about sort of 7 or 8 in the evening because he'd been doing other stuff at EMI. And he said, come to EMI, we'll do the interview here. And it was in someone's office, Brian, maybe Brian Munson, with the blinds drawn. And it was incredibly downbeat. And I remember thinking he really sort of seemed like a kind of beaten man at that point. You know, he was really beaten down by what had happened.
Yeah. It wasn't just that. It was also his wife.
Everything else. Yeah, exactly. Everything. Yeah. But he was very much not the force that you're describing, the kind of up and at 'em lads. You know, he would become that again later.
But I think he felt he was banging his head against the wall, you know, and he must have felt that they were all against him, which they really were by that point. That tour I did with them when I did their book, you know, we were all best mates forever and ever for a long time. Then I did that tour, and I used to sit on that tour bus, and one by one they'd all come out and get on the bus, and it was all jolly. And then Fish would get on, and everybody would shut up.
Right, yeah.
You know, that horrible thing when you walk in the room and they sort of go, oh, he's here now, he's here now, he's here. It was horrible. Yeah. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And on that note,
on that bombshell,
we will return.
Well, we've got to wait for your Fish interview to come out to find out all the things.
And can I say,
said.
If you've enjoyed this, it's because of our beautiful microphones.
Oh, yes, we were. Sorry, we
had to say
Dynamic. Beyer Dynamic. They're the kings of microphones.
You know, at our show, people were saying to me, I really love your new mics. You sound amazing now on the pod.
Yeah, definitely.
That happened, yeah. So yeah. Beyer Dynamics.
Fish would love Beyer Dynamics.
Ah,
vodka intimate.
Yeah. Problems.
An affair with isolation in a black.
How do I stop this, Fern?